Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast. Once again, my name's Eric. Our good friend Ray is actually off this week, so filling in for him this week is none other than Don Husen, friend of the show. How are you this evening, Don?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. We had a robust schedule, aggressive itineraries, like to say, at work. So a couple things. We had 4 GT and major level events this past weekend. We had Forge World opening their doors to show us all kinds of neat stuff that none of it had to deal with 40K, so we can kind of skip over that. And of course, we've got a hot topic that related to one of those major events. So quick review, if you did miss the Forge World news, lots of stuff for Necromunda, lots of stuff for Horus Heresy, and a large debut of Adeptus Titanicus with mini Titans, pocket-sized Titans. Matter of fact, one of the Titans fit in someone's pocket, and somebody walked off with one of them.
Those jerks.
Yeah, it's pretty lame. But yeah, somebody walked off with one of the Titans. But it's interesting, yeah, the new scale, give you an idea, the Knights that we're used to in 40K being these gargantuanly tall models, they're about the size of a Terminator in this new game. So it's kind of neat to see all the models out there and see the game being played. Unfortunate incident, so I hope whoever did walk off with that Titan comes to their senses and returns it. That being said, 3 events this past weekend, Don. 3.
Yep.
So let's start in America's Heartland, East Forks, Minnesota, at the Slaughterhouse GT. So interesting event here. We'll go over your top 8. Starts with, in 8th place, Jeremiah Pettit with Adeptus Custodes, Nicholas Lucas with Imperial Knights. In 6th place, Mark Weiss, also with Imperial Knights. Ben Cherwin with Adeptus Custodes comes in 5th place. James Kelling with a Latok finishes 4th. In 3rd place, Mike Smith with Thousand Sons. 2nd place, Nicholas Weiss with Imperial Knights. And your 2018 Slaughterhouse GT champion is none other than Kyle Thompson with Catachan Jungle Fighters. So unfortunately, only a few players in the whole tournament actually uploaded their lists, but we're seeing a lot of the same familiar factions now in the top 8. So what was once heralded as 8th edition being the great edition of parody, has that gone away with the recent Codex releases?
You might think that. But I also think that it's just because of those Codex coming out, people are trying out those new codexes, especially with something as influential as the Imperial Knights. Hence why I see in that top 8, there's 3 Imperial Knight players, and there's three other Imperial armies, which might or might not have had an Imperial Knight or 2 in there.
Yep, 2 Custodes, 1 Catachan, Jungle Knights. Jungle Fighters.
And, you know, to be fair, Custodes have always been doing well. And Catachans in particular, along with Cadians, but Catachans have been doing very, very well for iGuard. So those aren't too hard to figure out what they're doing. Thousand Sons came in at number 3 with their great little showing.
Yep.
And that, I'm sure, has nothing to do with the fact that they have unmitigated smite, the ability to hide a lot of casting, and they're a solid Chaos army. They're probably one of, if not the best, Chaos army right now because of what they can do.
It's interesting. That's one of the few lists that was uploaded, and just a quick glance at it here. Starts off with a Thousand Sons Battalion with Ahriman on disc. Sorcerer, looks like he's walking with the Dark Crystal, and then 3 units of 10 cultists. Then follows it up with a Chaos Demons Battalion with a Poxbringer, Khorne Demon Prince with Axe and Skull Reaver, 3 units of Nurglings, 2 of with 3 models, 1 with 5, and then a unit of 1, 2, 3, 28 Bloodletters. Then last but not least, he comes in with a Thousand Sons Battalion. It's got a Demon Prince with Wings, Talons, Warp Bolter, and Helm of the Third Eye. Another Demon Prince with Wings, Talons, and Warp Bolter. He went for the triplicate there, and then 2 units of 10 cultists, and then 30 units of Zangors with a Brayborn.
That makes sense. Because with the Dark Crystal on that first sorcerer that he had, you can pick up the sorcerer and a unit of Thousand Suns Infantry and deep strike them anywhere on the table. Which, especially with the first edition beta rule, does not affect units already on the table. So he can just pop up with all that stuff 90s away from you. On top of the warp speeding, the ability to steal command points with that Helm of the Third Eye. It's just, it's a lot of, it's a lot of threats, and all those things are casting at least two or three psychic powers with bonuses most of the time.
Right.
And most of those are also ignoring the cumulative penalty for smite because they are Brotherhood of Psyker.
And I'm assuming he's using the Nurglings to kind of establish a landing pad.
Oh, I'm sure he's creating a nice little drop zone with those Nurglings.
Okay.
And then
the Bloodletters bomb. So.
Yeah. Bloodletter bombs are a thing. They definitely do work.
There you go. That is your Slaughterhouse GT for 2018. We're going to go across the pond to merry old England to the Caledonian Revolution. This is the sister tournament, sister event, I should say, to the Caledonian Uprising, which is Old English for I couldn't make it to LVO. And because it's held right around the same time of the year and also marks the beginning of the tournament season in the UK. So looking at their top eight, interesting bunch here. In eighth place, David Irving with Imperium. Seventh place, Max Barton with Imperium. Sixth place, Alex Harrison of London GT fame and Tau Empire coming in sixth. Fifth place, Mike Porter with an Imperium list. Fourth place, Colm McCarthy with Drukhari. Also playing the Imperium list, coming in third, is Gordon Wilson. Second place, Conrad Barkowski with Eldari. And your Caledonian champ for this season is Manny Chima with Imperium. So I have to guess, and there's quite a few comments here, what the situation is, why so many Imperium lists and what constitutes an Imperium list.
Curious if they are not implementing the Battle Brothers beta rule. Because if so, then that makes perfect sense.
That might be the case here. I'm actually doing a quick look.
Which would also, if they're not using that rule, they're probably not using the rule of three. They're probably not using the psychic focus rule. No, that's not a beta rule anymore. That's actual.
That is the law, sir.
But yeah, those two for sure are beta rules. So you might have seen like Playbrush Crawler spam or Hive Tyrant spam or something like that over there too. But I'm not sure how well those do with the Knight meta that is sweeping 40k right now. And also, those Imperium armies probably did have some Knights in them. Just throwing that out there.
Also find it interesting, too, with the different missions that they run. And it's also a very different approach. And much more the traditional book missions where winning on the last turn is a big deal. So, and sometimes you have lists that come out of some in that format. They really don't have that hitting power because all they have to do is outlast, you know, six rounds of gameplay and hold the objectives. The
infamous 80 Nurgling army that did fairly well at LGT.
Correct.
And that's because those missions were along those lines.
Right. As well as several of those Poxbringer hordes and the like. So, whereas here in the States, we see a Pox, you know, it's still difficult to kill, but I'm like, woohoo, Reaper points, let's get them. So that was our second event. Again, most of this was found on their Facebook page. So unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of lists to look at for this particular event. But we do have one more event, and it's a big one. And that is T-Shift, otherwise known as the Seattle Hearts of Fire Tournament. Lovely Bellevue, Washington, home of Microsoft. And looking at their top eight, we're going to have some very familiar faces if you listened to the show in the past. Starting in eighth place with Imperial Knights, Zachary Nelson. Seventh place, JT McDowell with Drukhari. Sixth place, Kevin Cuccino with Death Guard. In fifth place, High Fleet Leviathans, helmed by James Reeves. Scott Carnes with Cadian Shock Troops comes in fourth place. A name from the past makes a triumphant return. John Paul Mauwet with Cabal the Black Heart comes in third. Gary Sacco with Imperial Knights comes in second. And your 2018 T-Shift champion is Captain Hellhound himself, Mitch Pelham, with Catechin Jungle Fighters. So interesting, Drukhari re-established themselves in the top eight. Still a fair amount of Imperial Knights making the top eight. But nice to see some Death Guard. We got some Tyranids. Different format or just a different crowd?
So one of the things that I do think is happening is, as you might have heard over the last couple of these reports that we've done so far, there hasn't been a whole lot of Dark Eldar. And I think it's because a lot of Dark Eldar do not have the tools to handle all these knights that are coming out. They're getting gatekeepered out. Amen.
Yeah, definitely finding that out the hard way.
And it's what's commonly out there right now. On the other hand, looking at this event, let me get to what this event's actual scoring system is too. It's not Swiss as far as scoring goes. It's definitely a scoring where it's total battle points, which is one of those things you have to score high every game to get higher placements. Regardless of whether or not you win all your games or not, if you score low with all your wins, you're not going to score higher than someone that lost a couple games where they just scored massive amounts, which, like our second and third place player, second place player had 2 losses, 3 wins. Third place player had 4 wins, 1 tie. But because the second place player had high scoring wins, like he had a 39, a 40, a 36 for the wins, and pretty good losses, 19 and 28, he was able to outscore someone that had like an average score of the high 20s for his wins. So that aside, we do notice that this has a large chunk of Astra Militarum in the top eight. I think I see 4 primary Astra Militarum armies. And I'm sure that the Knights probably have the battery. And yeah, then we have Tyranids and just the Dark Elder. And I think that's it. Aside from the Knights.
Right.
But yeah, Tyranids, they do have the tools to kill Knights, especially if there's good terrain. Hive Guard are still mean. And they do have a lot of fast-moving things that can grab objectives away from Knights for at least a turn. Judging based on the scoring, I'm assuming they use IDC missions. So those ones are really good for if you have the ability to grab objectives, even if you die the following turn. This is a way to get more points. And I think that's probably actually why our Imperial Knights player in third place didn't score that high, is because he probably had a lot of Imperial Knights, couldn't grab objectives away from his opponents, so he didn't score as high, except for it looks like he tailed someone turn or game 3.
Let's take a look at some of the lists. Start with our winner here, Mitch Pelham, and we've talked about this list a lot. So what has changed? A few small things. You'll probably notice it when we get to the end. So he starts off with brigade with Catechin. So he's got Colonel Strachan, company commander, and a Primaris Psyker, along with 3 units of infantry units with mortars, and then 3 units without infantry squads. Elite's got 2 astropaths and a Ministorum priest, as well as Ogryn bodyguard and 2 platoon commanders. In the fast attack spot, he's got, his ever favorite Hellhounds. He's got Artemedia Hellhounds, he's got 3 of them with the heavy bolter. And then the heavy support slots, he's got 3 units of 3 heavy mortar teams. And then he rounds it out with a second battalion of Blood Angels. He's got 2 captains on jump pack with Storm Shield and Thunderhammer, 3 units of 5 scouts. And here's the big change. He took out which super tank he had, but basically one of the Baneblade chassis, and replaced it with a Knight Castellan. 2 Siegebreaker cannons and 2 Cheesebreaker missiles.
And that probably served him well, especially if he played against the Dark Elder player. Burn through the Dark Elder player's command points a lot if you have a Castellan on the table. Because they will want to stop that thing from doing everything it does. Which it still
was. I'm just thinking here. So he gets 12 command points, then another 5, 17, 20, 23? 20,
no, 20.
No, 21.
Oh, sorry.
20.
12 plus 5, 17 so, plus 3, 20. Yeah.
Yeah, 20 command points.
And I'm sure that he has the battery in his catechins.
Yes, he does. It was in the smaller battalion, not in the brigade. But yeah, the company commander had the they're generating command points.
Gotcha.
Now put that in comparison to the knight player you talked about earlier. He's got a knight warden, so Avenger, Gatling cannon, heavy flamer, thunder gauntlet, heavy stubber, and Icarus rocket pod. Two armigers with auto cannons and heavy stubber. Then, oh, these are fantastic. They're out of order. Another battalion involving Pask, Primaris Psyker, one unit of 10 guardsmen, one unit of 5 scions with hotshot las cannons and 2 melta guns. Might have had to double downed on that. And then 2 scout sentinels with heavy flamers. And then last but not least, he's got not one, not two, 3 shield captains on Dawn Eagle bikes with hurricane bolters.
That sounds like an annoying list. I really still do like Tempest of Scions. They're actually, in my opinion, still a very, very good addition to any Astra Militarum army. But that's probably because I have a friend that has used Stormtroopers his entire Astra Militarum life. And I've seen what they can do in the hands of a really good player. Aside from that, the Dawn Eagle jet bikes are really good. They work in... They're very similar to how Captain Becky works, the Blood Angel captain. But they have a lot more ability to both shoot and take damage than little Becky does. They just cost more.
Which one's faster?
So... Technically speaking, a base stat point, the captain on jet bike is, the shield captain on jet bike is. Captain Becky, she's able to use a whole lot of redeployment shenanigans, 3d6 inch charge, things like that, if you have the command points to shove into that model. The shield jet bike captain, I believe, can also do the swooping dive, which is at the end of your opponent's charge phase, you can charge them. So they work very differently, but I think overall that shield captain on jet bike is faster and has more utility than the Blood Angel captain does.
Quick look at Scott Karn's list. He has a Cadian shock troop list and not a single super heavy to be found anywhere in this list. Starts off once again with... Looks like a battalion. He's got 2 company commanders and Commander Pask, as well as a Primaris Psyker in the HQ slot. 1, 2, 3, 4. I take it back. This is a brigade. 6 units of guardsmen. Looks like they all have the... interesting. He took the plasma gun instead of the typical mortar. So he all took them.
Oh, it's because they deep strike.
Okay.
Yeah, the Cadian shock troops, there are a deep striking army.
Okay, so he's all got plasma gun and auto cannon on each of them, all 6 of them. The elite spot, he's got 3 veterans with special weapons, all 2 of them with a sniper rifle, 1 with a las cannon, commissar, and an Ogryn Bulgarin squad. Looks like it's hard to tell how many. Okay. Fast attack slot. It's got 1 armored sentinel and 2 scout sentinels, both with autocannons. Heavy support slot, basilisk, 3 heavy weapon squads with mortars, and a Lehman Russ battle tank. Then follows that up with a supreme command detachment with Space Marine Captain, Blood Angels, there it is. Jump Pack, Storm Shield, Thunder Hammer, Mephiston, and then Librarian Dreadnought. Then last but not least, he has an auxiliary support detachment with Celestine.
All right. With a list like this, I love how it looks. I can't imagine that any of his games finished at all. And that's how a lot of those moving or deep striking, anything like that type of high model count armies are, where they just take forever just for the movement phase alone, let alone the shooting phase because they're guard, or the charging phase if they're, you know, catch and jungle fighters. I'm curious if this event used chess clocks. Let's see. He scored pretty high for all of his wins. One of his wins, he only got 24, but all the others were high 30s, and one loss at 15. But, yeah, he must have just been tabling people, I guess, because that is a lot of DACA. And then on top of that, you still have the Blood Angel portion of it with the Librarian Dreadnought and everything like that that are punching things to death. I like it. It's just need to be really fast with that, and probably need to be young so you have a good back.
Understood. But a decent amount of board presence, like I said, large amount of DACA. Kind of a... I don't think any one part, like if you took it out, would cripple the list. It's got a little bit of everything in there, but on the same point, some of the more fringe lists or the gatekeeper lists, that's where I kind of look at, like, okay, does he really have enough firepower to take that out? So, all right. So that is T-Shift 2018. Glad to see that event back in action. So after the break, we'll go over the big one over the weekend, the American Team Championships. That's right. ATC 2018 is in the books and lots to talk about right after the break.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
And we are back after the break. And if those of you who are following on the Exterminatus Facebook page, you'll notice I gave a couple updates over the weekend. And after the first day of play at the ATC, we saw some interesting matchups. And then moving into the second day, one of the key things was we saw the two-time defending Team Happy going up against some key competition within the group. And right off the bat, they were able to hang on for a win against the Kamikazes and then pull out a tie at 200 points between the Has-Beens, which is an interesting team of Alan Baramovich, Nick Rose, and Ben Moley, and a few other familiar names from years past, which makes me a little bit concerned that after 3 years after winning the ITC championships, you're considered a Has-Been. But no big deal. So with that tie, that actually put them in a bit of a bind because it allowed Beast Coast to jump ahead with a win. And at that point, something happened. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But long story short, let's go through the top eight real quick and celebrate the winners of the ATC Championship 2018. So coming in eighth place, Brohammer Meh Plus. It's an awesome name, guys. Seventh place, Endless Gaming. Sixth place, the Wobbly Modelers. Fifth place, General Staff, the Greater... sorry, guys, got cut off here. Fourth place, Quality Control, one-time winner as well. Third place, the aforementioned Has-Beens. In second place, the Warhogs. And in first place, a team of familiar names. Beast Coast, featuring Nick Nadavati, Tony Kopak, Brad Chester, and friends, taking the top spot, winning all but their last game, tying in the last round, is your ATC champion for this particular season. So one of the things that really leapt out at me before I get into all the controversy, there's an amazing number of ties in this event.
And that's just kind of weird considering that these are... So, ties? These ties are still... Well, the score overall is in the multiple hundreds. So, they're still using the ITC scoring, but they're adding all the scores together. Oh, I see what it is. Makes sense now. So,
what's that?
Looks like what they did, I'm just going through the actual rounds now, was you still won, lost, or drawed, based on what you did with your games. And it was whoever won more games, not whoever got more points.
Oh, that explains
for
it.
For overall.
Okay.
But I was looking through and I didn't find anyone else that had the same number of points as them in the last round. Let's see. What was their tie with? Oh, God, it's going to be a sec. But anywho, I also want to give a shout out to the wonderful, wonderful people that host the ITC stuff. Reese, Frankie, and those guys. They also participated in this tournament and they got 13th overall on Team Zero Comp. That's an awesome other team name. I just went across one that was Full Frontal Nerdity.
Yeah, there's some great names here. We'll go over some of the great names, despite not making it to the top eight. Definitely worthy of a mention here.
So, yeah, it looks like that.
Ungrateful last, Childhood. I like that one.
That last game, Beast Coast got 208 points and tied with the Has Beans, which was 192 points. So, yeah, they're not doing points to points. It's wins to losses.
Okay.
Still,
that makes sense.
And points are for the end part.
So a couple other team names that I thought gave me a chuckle: Men Who Stare at Ones, the Flavortown Five. Thought that was hilarious. What the FAQ? I like that one.
And there are a lot of
teams. I can't pronounce it because it's the Forge World model. But the what's the Super Chicken's name?
ABC.
Yeah.
Where is it?
So make it, they spelled it out, but let's make ABC great again. I thought that was awesome.
Where's that one at? Oh, there.
It's right below the one you mentioned, Full Frontal Nerdity, which is also a great name.
I'm going to give it a try. Hashtag make a Taraukiris great again. So there's my butchery of the alphabet chicken.
There we go.
I'm wondering. Yeah, I have no access to their list, but I'm curious if they actually did put ABC in there.
I'd be curious. So if he's even, actually, is he even allowed?
It is. So it is allowed. It's only 1,500 points, and it's just a Lord of War.
Okay.
It is still a single 1,500 point model, which I'm not sure how well that would do in this setup where you have teams pairing off against each other,
right,
player to player, player to player, especially if he gets an unfavorable matchup where it's like, all right, you're one model, try to kill 600 plague bears, go.
Yeah, that would be bad. That might, well, though, I think you could make a run for it. You can make it happen.
Yeah, but the same, well, 600 plague bears is going overboard. I think you can only fit like 210-ish in a list. But even still, those guys walking forward and poking Mega Chicken, they do a lot of damage if you fail save.
Right. So first of all, great to see, it's a couple things going on at this particular event. First, it's, some of the greatest 40K players in the United States all coming together in a team tournament. So you have that added layer of each team is picking their matchups and trying to outposition the other team to get the most favorable matchups to win the most games. You and I participated in a similar formatted tournament, and that can kind of make or break some of the round for that particular team. But interesting, so some people are making a huge deal about these are the lists of the greatest players, but part of me is like, well, if you can pick your matchups, then you can design your lists around that. So I'm not sure if these lists are truly the meta moving forward, or just sort of interesting side talk for a very unique event.
And I really would not take any of these lists for anything but an ATC or ETC, well, ATC style tournament. The reason being is all these players, which there are five players on each team, none of them could share any of the specific factions with each other. So like, Space Marines couldn't be with Space Marines. Blood Angels couldn't be with Blood Angels. Heretic Astartes could not be with Heretic Astartes. Tyranids could not be with Tyranids. That kind of thing. So they had to figure out how they'd work in between those, and they had to figure out based on some of these people went really hardcore into this setup, which is where you have, your defending team, where you have the hundreds of Plague Bearers that just don't give up points and hold the objectives for the entire game. And their whole entire purpose is to soften the blow on someone's really hard-hitting army.
Right.
Things like that. So I would not bring these because none of them are, well, there probably are a couple, but none of them really are take-all comers lists, which means that they do have hard counters, really hard counters that will destroy them.
And that's also, you look at some of these individual performances, you could see a player lose most of their matches and still be considered the MVP of their team, because as they're losing matches, but they're also keeping the game close, denying the, you know, the, it's a game that, yeah, he's matchup wise he's supposed to lose, but he keeps it close enough so he actually is eroding points away from the opponent instead of getting smashing victory. He's kind of gets a close game, and so now the other players have to make up the difference in tougher matchups. So yeah, I kind of looked at, some people made a huge big deal about the lists, and I was kind of like, eh. And then especially for the ETC, it was, you have that added layer of not only are they using this team format, but they're also using totally different mission set than we do here in the States. And I was just like, okay, let me know how it goes. Which, I don't know. It's always been my, it's one of the most frustrating things about the ETC for me. It's, you know, the world's greatest players in the kind of a World Cup format, and but they create such an oddball format that you're like, I don't know what game you guys are still playing. So
all I know is we're apparently 6 months behind.
Yeah.
At all times.
At all times.
Even though they stole my list from LVO.
Yeah. No one saw
those
that
jerks.
One. So it's reared its ugly head once again. We've had a large competitive event, and the notion of cheating, cheaters, once again has reared its ugly head. And several people who are not there are eyewitness accounts of what happened, and a lot of that's being posted on the internet. Interesting enough, right before coming on, Aaron Along, who was on Team Happy, did give an interview with DropPod, sort of a video chat, and it's been posted on the internet. So take a look at that, and he gives his side of the story. This story is still developing as of our recording tonight. There was an announcement made by the tournament organizers of the ATC that they will have a statement later this week, but it will not be today. So interesting how all that runs down. But the long and the short of though is, astute listeners will notice, we did not mention Team Happy in the top eight, despite the fact that they were 4-1 on day one. So, Don, I don't know if you want to elaborate what the story is, at least what we, story as we know so far.
All right. And just to amend what you said, there was actually an official posting by the ATC about what had happened. They definitely did a very PR version of it, though. But you will see all sorts of the tabloid type stuff as far as like Spiky Bits or Abel Lost Souls, where people did their emotional responses initially, right when Team Happy was, as they put it, disqualified. Both Team Happy and the ATC stated that they were asked to leave, and they did. This was after several incidents along the way, one of which involved having war gear on his models, both modeled as such and then played as such without paying the points or putting it on his list, which was plasma pistols on his Sisters of Battle Sergeants. So that was game one, game two. He figured out game two, had it fixed, went back, apologized to his earlier opponent. Apparently everything was okay. They got a warning and kept going. Game three, I believe it was, there was an altercation verbally, which was, I don't have all the details on them, but I'm sure it'll come out here soon. But it sounds like both players on both sides were extremely emotional at that point, and it was very much so a salt shaker type thing. And then the following, I think it was game four or game five, I'm not sure which one, someone brought to the attention of the organizers that that same team was using models, and I shouldn't say models, they were pre-painted toys as counts as models for Rough Riders that were much smaller and whatnot. You can go all into the, it was definitely a thing that you could consider modeling for Advantage. They were tiny and easy to hide, things like that. But they had a very specific set of model guidelines that those had clearly violated, which was you cannot put pre-painted toys on the battlefield. They had to be models count that work as counts as or something along those lines. And if you did have any questions, you needed to, or you know, any counts as period, you need to run it past the TO first to get an okay. None of that had happened, and he had already played all of his games. And by that time, they brought Team Happy up and had another talk with them, and they agreed to remove themselves from the event. So that is what I can guess as far as the actual story thus far. But like I said, it was both from the Bell of Lost Souls, Spiky Bits, it's the same article, they just both posted it. That emotional response, followed by the Aaron A. Long interview, which he didn't really deny any of that part, so I'm trying to keep everything together. And the ATC's formal response to the community. That's what it sounds like has happened. And the reason why the ATC didn't get around to it sooner, it's a really large event, guys. It's, how many teams was it? 74 teams of 5 people. That's almost as big as the LVO. And they were running a little bit behind at the time that these things kept happening. They took care of it. They even had a judge that had to babysit, for lack of a better term, the tables because of the verbal altercation and the rules disputes that were going on. Which, don't get me wrong, rules disputes are a thing. Don't ever feel bad for asking someone if their rules are wrong, anything like that. But don't make it violent, whether it's verbally, physically, anything like that about it. If you have any questions, go get a judge, get it fixed. But yeah, it was a plethora of issues, at which point the judges determined it was best if the team in question would withdraw. So that is pretty much what had happened with them, and they did not wind up playing their game 6.
So a lot to go through there. As mentioned, Aaron Long has given an exclusive interview to Drop Pod, showing his side of the story, and you guys can watch it for yourselves to draw your own. So let's start with the first thing. So he talked about the plasma pistols, and basically what it came down to is they were practicing multiple lists, and mentally in his mind, he had the models out there, and he was playing the list in his mind, which was not the list that he had turned in. You know, it was vision number 58, and he was playing with version number 57. I guess the question comes in, honest mistake, maybe not. Some people are drawing to conclusions. The one thing I did interesting when he talks about and seems to be fairly consistent is he brought it up with his opponent, and his opponent had him redo the 2-hit rolls in that particular method, and then they moved on. He then also apologized to his first round opponent, so it only affected the first 2 games. But being that we kind of started the show off with these are the greatest players in the United States, do we hold them to too high a standard? Because this is a mistake that happens fairly often at your average Friday night at the game store.
And I'm of the opinion that it should not. You have a list. It's right in front of you. Unless, for some reason, you decided not to bring it for some weird reason. But you have a list. You build the models. You should know what your list entails, regardless of how many iterations that you do. And especially at a place that had that high of a modeling restriction as far as what you could even bring. You should basically be looking at your army before you even submit your list and say, all right, these are exactly what I have, and or the reasonable counts as that have been pre-approved by judges. And this is what I need to fill out for points, and this is what I'll submit, especially because they have their list submissions in June. So this is 3 weeks later, and I mean, that gives you 3 weeks to even just look at your list, review it, make sure that you know everything you're doing. Because the last thing anyone wants to do is be called a cheater, or even just like gotcha moments, cheater moments, or just forgetful moments. Forgetting is one thing that we've all done, where we've gone, did I shoot my seeker missile last turn? Did I shoot my hunter killer? Did I do this? Did I do that? Or, you know, I rolled that entire phase and I was a tier down on my Titan, something like that. And it happens. Unfortunately, you need to try to do the best you can to try to mitigate that, or find a way to make amends to your opponent. Like, after you finish shooting that Titan, everything that died, just say, you want to just put it all back? We can re-roll it. Do you want to leave it as is? Put it in your opponent's hands. That way there's no feel bads. The feel bads are where these stories come from. Because as much as I've heard, and granted, I've only heard the actual stories, the straight-up stories, from actually Aaron with his interview. But the only time that these stories happen are when someone feels like they got cheated and they feel bad about things. Granted, Aaron's first opponent was Frankie, and I don't think Frankie cares. But that's Frankie. He's there to just roll dice and socialize. But it happens. You need to find some way to make it a fun experience for you and your opponent, regardless of whatever happens with what you accidentally did.
So another thing to look at is, as you went through the story, the tournament organizers issued a warning. So one of the things that's kind of been kind of this contradiction, the success of the ITC has always been, here are the guidelines, but basically run your event. You don't have to run ITC missions. You don't have to use win-loss. You can use battle points. I think the only requirements is, I think it has to be over 1,000 points and you use Swiss pairings. It's pretty much the only requirements that you're kind of pigeonholed into. Yet all of a sudden now there's this outcry from TOs, we need a system for penalizing players for cheating. And everything's extended from, as you know, warnings to points reductions to ban from events and all that. So I'm kind of at this, where does the ITC come in to give, you know, basically give TOs the means or the tools to police these players?
Yeah, and I have seen this post, and especially with this past weekend, the amount of stuff that's popped up in the ITC TO group, and I'm sure that's been in other groups too, since I'm sure that event was not just watched by ITC personnel. But there are people that are afraid that it will both be turned into another form of cheating, which is going to be the people finding things that their opponent hasn't done wrong and whatnot. But the logistics of it are a big pain in the butt. It's really, really hard to police the 4,000 or 5,000 players in the ITC to make sure that everything they do is purely okay, that whoever has been banned, how long that they're banned, whether their ban is even warranted or whether it's a false accusation, things like that. It really does come down to the TOs. At their clubs, their regions, because to be fair, it is a tiny, tiny world. TOs talk to each other. And if there's someone that is a major issue, you can bet your butt that TOs will be like, you can't show up to this event, or you can't do this. I know we've, in our local area, we've had to do that to one local person and one person that has traveled here a couple times, because they were just problem people that were bad for events. And it's up to the tournament organizers of each event to stop it before it begins, and if it does happen, to make sure that everyone is aware of the consequences of what will happen. having just a regular event like the ITC, like LVO, for example, where someone shows up and they have, you know, a dice that has two fives instead of a five and a two on the dice. And it's like, you know, three or four dice in their collection, but you never tell. But once someone found it, they just go, all right, well, get rid of those dice and don't do it again. That's not, in my opinion, proper punishment for something along those lines. Regardless of however they did it, they should be checking all their stuff to make sure that they are not cheating someone. Ignorance is not the same as innocence. You need to be able to make sure that all your stuff is correct, or at least as correct as possible. So if there's an issue, the community, so not even the TO, the community as a whole has to correct it. Whether it's making sure the person knows about it, trying to coach the person on it. If they're uncoachable, then just finding they're making sure that they're not allowed to go back to events for X amount of time, or if it's something major, like they going way off the deep end here. Say they stab their opponent with a one of the 6-inch stab or ruler things. Say they cause bodily harm to their opponent. In my opinion, that's grounds for get out of this event for the rest of your life. But that's just me. And I'm pretty sure I'm going on a rambling rant now. But the biggest thing is just make sure that you bring it to their attention. If they don't know about it and they just other people are talking about it behind their backs all the time and not talking directly to them or having someone talk directly to them, they're not going to correct it.
So the interesting rules we came into, the first thing that I saw, bans. The biggest thing I, as a TO, I go with, okay, if I ban someone, basically that's one less person come to my tournament, that's one less entry fee that I have. I may not have the luxury of banning that many people, so there's got to be some sort of alternative. But then you go to the other end of the spectrum, and this is something where we ran into this in a couple of events you and I have run together, is that by not banning this one troublesome player, I may be costing me five players who are not going to come because they don't want to run the risk of playing that player. So it's like, okay, trying to find what is the right balance in terms of, hey, this needs to stop, this needs to be curbed. Maybe the player is not even aware they're doing it. I don't think in either of these cases that was the case, but nonetheless, trying to find that right balance of what is that. And the next thing is, luckily, we have a very tight community. So, when we put the ban in place, it went pretty much statewide. There's always the whole, well, I guess I'm not allowed at that site because this happened where I used to live. You know, there are a couple groups of players. Well, I guess I won't go to that store's tournaments. They just went to the other store. And they played a whole bunch of tournaments there. And it wasn't until the store kind of figured out after the fact is, oh, these guys are the problem child, which is why those tournaments weren't doing so well and why my tournaments are not doing well and that other stores now, their tournaments are growing again. So eventually they do the lap. You know, they hit all five stores in the local community and they burn all their bridges and then they switch game systems. I still think the game's played by players and I got a good chuckle. One of those guys that when I first moved to this area, who was notorious for browbeating his opponents into submission, he doesn't play 40K anymore. He's playing one of those more popular games that people say is so much better than 40K, and I'm watching him in a tournament when things haven't changed at all. He's still a jerk. So that being said, I don't think that game system has a penalty or a system that works. So not sure how they're going to deal with him, but hey, it's their problem now. But so one of the other solutions out there, you know, I looked at other sports and how they do certain penalties. One of the ones I always draw the comparison, I think 40K as a sport, and I'm using air quotes on the radio, which is awesome, most resembles NASCAR. And why I say that is you practice as a team, you share information, but you still compete as individuals. You have still have the ability to build whatever in NASCAR, you build your car. In 40K, you build your army, but you can customize it to the event, as well as there is some sort of framework that the vehicle slash list needs to follow. That's why it's called stock car racing. And then last but not least, though, if you look at how they patrol, they one of the things they do is after the car has raced in the race, they go through an inspection. And lo and behold, sometimes, you know, those 14 seconds in the pit stop, they make adjustments to the car that are illegal. And the way they solve it is, hey, not only do you not get any points for playing this weekend, you also are going to lose points towards the season championship. So, for example, I could have come in first and win 113 odd ITC points by going to my local RTT. Instead, my list is illegal, and I not only lose that 113 points, but I could potentially lose another 25 points, up to 50 points towards the season rankings. Just putting it out there, of course, the hardest part is who at the ITC or Best Coast pairings, or how do they track that, and what are the guidelines for how much of a penalty you give out? No idea at this point.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's just one of those things that it will be someone's full-time job to do that. And then, like I was saying, who's going to investigate it to make sure that it is actually not just someone saying, I'm mad this person keeps beating up all my friends. It's an issue as far as anytime that you put in a way that someone can win by doing something bad to someone else, some people will actually go for that, which is unfortunate. But it's along the same lines as the whole slow playing thing. People were talking about dropping points. There are people that will still slow play regardless of how many points drop. They'll play a 100-point game of 40K, and they'll find some way to drag it out to 2.5 hours if they believe that going 2 or 3 turns is how they win the game.
And it's a legitimate strategy in other sports. I mean, you look at, and then they have their slow play mechanisms in place to prevent that. But one of the things I've been trying to teach my son when it comes to playing, he plays in youth league soccer. If your team has the ball, the other team can't score. So the longer you can hold on to the ball in possession, that's fewer opportunities that the other team has to score. That's not part of the rules in 40K. You know, 40K, especially with the time, the chess clocks now put in place, it's an interesting experiment, but it's right now the most fair solution. And really, at this point, if you're a tournament organizer and you haven't made an investment in those chess clocks, you're going to pay for it down the road. The event, we ran our largest event earlier in the year, and we promised a minimum of top 10 tables would have chess clocks. So if you look at our finances, we broke even on that event. That's right. Don and I do not get rich on running tournaments, contrary to popular belief. However, Don and I run more than one event a year. So if you start taking that as we run about, 6 events a year, I think about that. We run 6, and well, all of a sudden the cost, so we spent about $240 on chess clocks for that one tournament. But instead, if you take that cost and spread it over 6 events, now it becomes, I only spent $80 on chess clocks. And most of our other events are smaller events, so those chess clocks go deeper into the number of tables at the event. And then also, it also puts the onus back on the players. Okay, I better get used to playing with a chess clock. And as we found at our last event, the tables that didn't have a chess clock provided by us, they had their own. So, because people have, hey, I brought my own, or I've got the app on the phone, I'm good to go. So it's becoming part of the norm. And so if you do have questions, if you're a TO out there, hey, where'd you get $22 chess clocks from? I'm more than happy to share it, but you could probably save yourself some time and just find it on Amazon. That's where I got it. So, and it was interesting, they had free shipping. I was very excited about that. Hey, it makes those nickels and dimes add up. So that's one of those things where, yeah, the chess clock is a big deal. And as a player, I'm learning a lot more and managing my time and understanding how to use that clock, and no different than in professional American football, how you manage a 2-minute drill. It's not any different. You learn how to use the clock to your advantage as much as you can. And but going back to, and then when it comes to overall behavior, at the end of the day, guys, come on, it's a game of plastic soldiers. There really isn't any room for that. But the hardest part is they talk about sportsmanship scores. I don't know how you objectively measure someone's sportsmanship. It doesn't make it. I can have a feel bad moment and the other player didn't do anything wrong. My last game against Don was a feel bad moment for me. And it was so bad that it ruined Don's experience in the game. And it wasn't until I pulled my cranium from my rectum around round three that I realized this is a real game and we could actually make this enjoyable and make the game a little more fun. So had we not known each other and had this been a tournament, Don could be like, yeah, worst opponent. Definitely Eric. I would never want to play him again. But luckily he's on my team, so he's stuck with me. But those sort of things happen, and neither of us did anything illegal or cheating. It was just, it was a feel bad game, and I felt it was a bad matchup. But in the end, I learned a lot and move on from there. And I actually, next time I play an opponent with a similar list, I there's a glimmer of hope now. I can actually do something with this list. So moving forward, I mean, is this something where the ITC now has to appoint a commissioner? They look into these sort of things?
And I don't think that they will. I do think that they will have... It sounds like they're going to have a actual list of people that they're not allowed to go to events. But like I was saying, it's... For them to do it for their really big ones, LVO, SoCal, BAO, all those things like that. I don't think those are going to get implemented unless it's someone that is a major, major problem. Like I was saying earlier, when you grab your little 6-inch stand or your big old red whippet stick from way back when and you start beating on your opponent because they call your mom a obscene name or something like that, then you might have an issue. But guys, like he was saying earlier, it's a game. Understand, it is a game. Competition does not mean you have to be an ass to your opponent. Just have fun with each other.
The other thing I can think of as we look for, down the road in terms of the cheating thing, one of the things that also came up in this particular event was the assigning a referee to the table where the problem child is. So two things that come up. Number one of the members of Teen Happy is Tony Crepando, who became a legend for all the wrong reasons from last year's LVO, which is interesting, though, because although his name's been kind of drugged through the mud, it's amazing how many people I play now that know to do their deep strikes from reserve after the end of the moving phase. They all say, oh, can't move him yet onto the table. I don't want to get Tonied. And I'm like, look at that. So maybe he's made the game a better place with his indiscretions. But it's interesting, he's back, he's on Team Happy. And once again, he's in the crosshairs for poor play. So one of the comments, I'll try to clean it up for radio here, but kind of like, if you're on the crosshairs, why would you even flirt with any impropriety at this point?
Some people are just tempting fate. Or they think, that's my one for the year. Maybe they'll give me a pass. So, who knows?
So the next one comes in. Okay, the referee is over at your table and you're on sitter duty at this particular point. Interesting thing, we had to do a similar event at one of our events as well, where we had, in this particular case, I even brought in a third referee. We had two referees for the event, brought in a third. And the important thing was is they were much more versed in the problem child's army. It was very interesting that the problem child became very agitated at this point. Just, why is the judge getting in my grill about correcting me on rules? And several times snapped at him, says, why don't you play your own game? And it was just like, why don't you play by the rules? So it was one of those, it's almost like, were we creating our own feel bad at this point? But so are we creating a feel bad at the expense of correcting one person's feel bad at the expense of another player? But it's also at this point, I kind of looked at it, all right, is this person even respecting the officiating of this particular event? and looking at what ramifications we have after it at that point.
Yeah. And then, of course, I'm always the I like the old draconian law when it comes to that kind of stuff, which is not quite, you know, kill him for it, but it's he may be a, for lack of a better term, a client at something that we are hosting, but he's also signing a verbal contract, more or less, or a community contract, more or less, where it is, I'm going to follow the rules to the best of my ability, and I will respect the tournament organizer, or in this case, now being the ref, which those are two very different things, but I'm going to follow whatever they say. It might be wrong, and I've come across this too, where a TO was wrong about something. I brought it to them later, and they said, oh, sorry about that, but you just have to go with whatever the TO says, go with it. Unless you have something out there and you can say, wait, I think it's this way, and talk a little bit more with them. But if you literally have a ref that's sitting there with you, especially if he's getting your rules right and you're continuously getting them wrong, don't argue with him. It's just, that's stupidity. Don't do that.
Yeah. In another moment, again, watching the World Cup with my son, and he's going, why are they arguing with the ref? And I kind of laughed. I don't know why. I've never seen a ref change his mind. Now, you can definitely get makeup calls later in the game. You may be able to pressure a ref into start, but generally what they do is they heighten the, the mulligan level, lack of a better term. So now if it's a borderline foul, it's now a foul. So careful what you wish for when these sort of things. So kind of get the hint. All right, let's stick to this and move forward in terms of the way it's supposed to be played. And but it does put another onus back on the tournament organizers as what is the right ratio of referees to players at this point. And, to, you know, especially if you've got problem child, you don't want to be distracted. I mean, taken away from what if you have multiple problem childs. And what are your repercussions at the end? You know, it's one of those, you know, how do you make amends? And that's, you know, so with the rest of the group. Because that's actually another thing that came up here at the ATC is the other team captains coming forward to the judges. We've got a problem about people doing this. They weren't necessarily the teams that were playing against this infringing team. So how much of a say do they really have at this point? Well, they can always vote with their feet and vote with their dollars and not come back next year. That could be detrimental to an event.
Yeah. And then I just want to, I kind of tapped on it a little bit. There is a very large difference between a tournament organizer and a referee. Referee is what you see at a football game, baseball game. Well, that's an umpire.
They're different names.
You know, it's the guy usually wearing the black and white stripes, the one throwing flags, the one doing whatever needs to happen to ensure that the rules are played to the best of their ability. A referee is someone who is actively watching and participating in said game, which when someone gets a rule wrong, they interject. Or even if they think there's a rule wrong, they interject. You can contest that rule and say, no, this is how it is. Pull out what you think, your evidence for why something is the way that you think it is versus what the ref said. And sometimes, every once in a while, you'll see where refs do overturn calls. Like, a lot of times you see it in football where they stick their head under the thing and watch a replay. But that the ref, his whole job is to make sure that what he sees is going on is completely fair. It's completely legal within the restrictions of the rules that are available. And that no one is doing anything shady, whether it's rolling dice behind a piece of terrain and for some reason they always manage to hit, save, whatever. They never miss, never fail. And just like, all right, you either need to roll this out in front of everyone or you need to let your opponent come around and see them. Because something fishy is going on here. Or whether it's Mank is going to cast his sixth power right now. It's like he can only cast four. if he's a warlord, I think. Yeah, it's refs are there to put themselves into the game. A TO is not there to put themselves in the game. They can put themselves in the role of a ref, but a TO is making sure that the event is running. So they're providing a venue. They're providing, most of the time, terrain. They're providing basically a time frame in a certain area for you to attend, in addition to pairings, rankings, things like that. That is a TO. And understanding the difference between a TO and a ref is very important. If a TO is being a TO, you can't, well, you can ask them if they'll be willing to watch your game for a little bit and act as a ref. But don't assume that just because a TO is walking around looking at games, that he's going to throw himself headlong into a game as soon as he hears something fishy. That is not the role of a TO. That is the role of a ref. And refs do cause feel bads if they're not warranted.
And it is a tricky spot in terms of finding a good ref can make or break an event, and finding the resources and how to solve and that. And that's one of the things that, looking at certain events, and I've been to quite a few across the country now, you know, looking at what is the standardized format and what's there. So if there was, let's put it this way, if there is at least some sort of guidelines, or hey, as a ref, this is what seems to work best in terms of resolving some of this. I've learned it from practice. I by no means do not know all the rules, and I make that very clear when somebody comes up to me with a question. And actually, 80% of the time, I'm like, well, let's get the rule book out and read it. And I read it out loud, and they go, oh. And it usually resolves the rules dispute, which is hilarity in its best. It's gotten a lot easier with 8th edition. They're just not like this four-jeweled unit with an FAQ from 6 months ago doesn't quite jive with the new edition. You know, just all that nonsense, all that's kind of gone at this point. But, you know, I've been also fortunate where we haven't had the physical altercations or the shouting matches in quite some time. So, but I know, Don, you've been a ref as well as a TO. I mean, most of the questions and rule disputes that you're getting are
The good news is most of the, I mean, funny as it sounds, the last event that I ran, it was a 3-round RTT. I had maybe 2 questions, and it was extremely simple things, but it was interpretation things. And that was all it was just, hey, just want to know, like, soul burst and explosion. What order does this happen? Because I killed it. It explodes. I have a soul burst action. When does this happen? So it was a couple things like that had happened. Or how Treason of Tzeentch, it takes over an enemy character and you're allowed to shoot it, charge with it, fight with it. Someone was asking. He took over a character, it charged into a unit and died in Overwatch. Who got the point for killing a character? So it was things like that where it was like, all right, well, just clearing up how interactions with missions work and how interactions of when things happen works. And that was pretty much it. For the most part, the edition's fairly smooth as far as how it runs now. Just a couple of the new stratagems that people are like, I don't understand, or they're... If there are disputes, people are probably just opening up their codexes and actually looking at them and going, oh, that makes sense, and closing it without having to pull a TO over. Because, generally speaking, that's all you need to do with this edition is open your book, look at the actual rule, read it entirely, not the first half of the first line. Read it entirely and see what it says. For the most part, it is actually fairly clear.
So if you have any other suggestions, comments, or your experiences as a referee, TO, or and vice versa, as well as how you've dealt with some problem players, make sure to find us on our Facebook page at the Exterminatus Facebook, and leave your comments there. I'd love to see what your feedback is, because clearly this is something is still an issue here with our current competitive meta. It's something we definitely need to walk away from. I think that's the worst part, is we actually talked about the event for about 10 minutes and talked about the scandal for the next 30 minutes. And this is, again, a collection of some of the top-ranked players from across the country, an event as large as LVO in a team format, and that gets overshadowed by a couple of knuckleheads. So let's find a way to make our sport, our game, better, and I'd love to see your feedback. So after the break, we will review the ITC Top 10, as well as your upcoming ITC events. All right, welcome back from the break. It's time to review your ITC Top 10 for this week. First, I got to give a shout out to my co-host for this evening. Don, you're hanging in there at number 19.
Working on it.
Doing a great job there. Best of luck in your next few events. And correct me if I'm wrong, you are attending the Bay Area Open coming up?
I am, with a grand total of 8 models.
Give you a hint, what he's playing, and it's not orcs. Okay. Meanwhile, let's look at the rest of the top 10. Sliding down, looks like 2 spots. Actually, no, take it back. He's back in the top 10 after a brief absence. Ryan Verbeek with 566 points. Bruce Merker hangs on to the 9th place spot with 572 points. John Lennon drops down a spot, as does TJ Lanigan from last week. Denny Olivas also falls down to 6th place. Jeff in Control Robinson drops down from 4th to 5th place. Holding steady, I should say, is Nick Gower. Nick Gower actually drops a spot as the top Dark Eldar player in the top 10. Leaping up several positions, though, is Captain Hellhound himself, Mitch Pelham, with his big win at T-Shift. He vaults into 3rd place with 593 points. In 2nd place, we have Josh Death, who has made up some ground on your current leader, which is none other than Matthew Rutt, stays on top of the leaderboard for this week at the ITC Championships. So Matt Rutt has a 56-point lead over Josh Death. Josh then has a commanding 98-point lead over Mitch Pelham, which is actually shaved off by 3 points. Last week, he had a 101-point lead of then third-place Nick Gower.
42 points over Mitch.
I can't do math. There we go. Sorry, it's right. Mitch is 98 points behind Matt Rutt, is what I was trying to say. So 56-point lead for Matt Rutt over Josh Death. Josh Death has a 40-odd-point lead over Mitch Pelham. Interesting enough, as you look at the logjam, though, between 4th and 7th place, so that's Nick Gower, Jeff Robinson, Danny Olivas, and TJ Lanigan, a whopping 4 points separates those players. So the slightest little mistake can easily affect your top 10 rankings significantly. John Lennon hanging in there, 111 points off the pace set by Matt Rutt. Bruce Merker, 119 points off the lead. And Ryan Verbeek, 125 points. So a little bit of room there as well, as we have several large events coming up in the next few weeks. So make your travel plans. So meaning next weekend, if you're heading out to Stowe, Pennsylvania, you have the Summer Slaughter GT. Heading north of the border to escape the summer heat at the Toronto, Ontario, at the Tabletop Gaming Expo. I believe that is Attack X is the name of the 40K event there. Speaking of cold weather, WinterCon 40K is this next weekend. You're probably thinking, WinterCon, what are these clowns thinking? These guys are running the event in Canberra, Australia. It is winter that time of year currently. That made no sense. It's winter in Australia is what I'm trying to say. And last but not least, the Show Me Showdown Grand Tournament in Kansas City, Missouri is also this weekend. Other big events to look forward to, looking a little farther in our crystal ball, the Barnyard Brawl Grand Tournament 2 in Greenville, South Carolina. That is July 28th. The Grimgart GT in San Antonio, Texas, also July 28th. And hey, I know the guys who run that store. Awesome. Good luck, guys. That same weekend in United Kingdom, Southport, the Northwest Open. And of course, at Game Castle, Mountain View, California, the aforementioned Bay Area Open, July 28th and 29th. That will round out this month's large events. Directly right after that in August, by the way, is the MAGS Championship at Gen Con. So if you're going to Gen Con, they will be having several events, including, you know, that's one of the few events that's probably seen exponential growth, is the 40K event at Gen Con. It used to be like a demo game, and now it's like blown up into a major tournament. So, Don, thank you again for filling in for Ray. We should have Ray back next week.
Sure thing.
Appreciate all your feedback, especially also all your help, as the two of us run just about a good chunk of the Arizona GTs and majors in our local area. When is our next event, by the way?
I believe it is August 17th and 18th. Let me double check here. Sorry, 18th and 19th. And that'll be a two-day GT.
Once again, that'll be at Imperial Outpost Games in Glendale, Arizona. So if you'd like to meet Don, Ray, and myself in person, or just, you know, tell me to my face how many mistakes I made this episode, that'd be a great place to come and enjoy yourself with a great five rounds of 40K action. In the meantime, thank you again for listening. If you have not left a comment or a review, please do so on iTunes. We would love to see the feedback, good, bad, or indifferent. Any other comments or breaking news, check out our Facebook page. Until next week, my name's Eric.
And I'm Don.
And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus Podcast.